This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon, everybody. There's still some folks grabbing food, but I think we better start because we have a lot to talk about and a limited amount of time. My name is Dan Doe, and I'm the co-director of the UCSF UC Hastings Consortium on Law, Science, and Health Policy. And I'm really happy to welcome you to our fifth annual Supreme Court Review. This is an opportunity for those of us on the UCSF campus to learn about the Supreme Court and the decisions that it's taken in its latest term. And we're always thrilled to have expert commentary and perspective from faculty from UC Hastings, as well as sort of discussion of these cases from our own faculty to understand the policy and social implications of the Supreme Court's decisions. This is a super cool year. Very interesting things happening on the court. Very interesting things happening in our political realm in general. So our goal today is to have some comments from our panelists and to leave time for you folks to ask questions at the end. Here today, and I'll introduce the whole panel and then let them take it from there, is David Fagman, who is a constitutional law expert and is the acting chancellor and dean and John F. DeGardi professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. David is also the founding director of the UCSF UC Hastings Consortium, and he's going to be talking about the court's term in general and in particular our interesting situation where we only have eight sitting members on the Supreme Court at the moment. Next, we're going to have some discussion of a very interesting and important case, Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstadt, from Daniel Grossman and Diana Green Foster. Dan is a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences here, and the director of Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, or ANSR. And Dan is a particularly interesting guest because he was an expert in this case, and his opinions and perspectives were cited many times by the court in their decision. Diana Green Foster is also at ANSR, a professor also in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences, and a demographer. So one of the important issues that we'll be focusing on this case is how evidence from health policy, health services, and health research has impacted this important court's decision. Then finally, Adams Dudley, who is professor of medicine and health policy at the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies and the director of the UCSF Center for Healthcare Value, will be talking about the third case coming up today, GoBuy versus Liberty Mutual Health Insurance Company. This is a case that has a fairly technical sounding result, but with big implications for how we do health services and health policy research and our ability to understand how our healthcare system is operating. So Adams is going to unpack this decision for us a little bit so we can understand its implications. So with that, I'll turn things over to David.
Stand. Thank you, Dan. So I was given 8 to 10 minutes. I will try to use every second of them. I typically teach in 50 to hour minute blocks, so I have to be sort of pulled off the stage. Also, talking about this Supreme Court term, it is fascinating. Nobody anticipated that Justice Scalia would be the first off the court, as it were. And it sort of turned the world upside down for lots of people and obviously raised lots of questions for the current presidential climate that we find ourselves in. So I was asked to talk a little bit about what it means from a constitutional perspective to have an eight-member court. To some extent, the only reason why it's even interesting is because the court is thought of as being very evenly divided. And to some extent, that's true, but not entirely true, in the sense that Justice Kennedy needs to be understood, as he was understood beforehand, as the swing vote. But as a swing vote, I should tell you a little bit about Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy is a swing vote toward the liberal side on human rights issues, civil rights issues, due process, equal protection. And he's a swing vote to the conservative side on states' rights, federalism issues, and executive action. And so for court watchers, it's somewhat predictable how the court is going to split when you have an eight-member court. Just to give you, so the areas that Justice Kennedy ended up being on the liberal side were, in this case, University of Texas versus Fisher, the affirmative action case, obviously the abortion case, Whole Woman's Health, and then historically he's been on the somewhat more liberal side on the death penalty context, both in terms of developmental capacity of minors to be executed under the Eighth Amendment, and also the question, which is a very important one for next term, of how you define intellectual disability also for purposes under the Eighth Amendment. And then, of course, he was the author of Obergefell, the same-sex marriage case. What it means to have an evenly divided court is that if the court does split 4-4, it means that the circuit court decision is affirmed, but it has no precedential value from the Supreme Court level. So a case that did split that way this year was the United States versus Texas, which was the immigration case where President Obama used his executive authority to pass certain regulations regarding immigration. The state of Texas sued the executive department, claiming that President Obama had exceeded his authority. Not surprisingly to us court watchers, Justice Kennedy went on the conservative side on that, and the court split 4-4. I understand that the Justice Department just a little while ago has asked the court to rehear the case after they have a complete complement of justices. Whether the court will grant that rehearing remains to be seen. I think inevitably the question of executive power will come back to the court when the court has a full complement. It also raises the question, and a lot of court observers have noted that so far the Supreme Court has granted certiorari. So the Supreme Court, for those of you who don't do this for a living, the Supreme Court is a court purely of basically voluntary jurisdiction, which means that they get to decide what cases they take and what cases they do not take. There are no cases in the modern times that they have to take as a court. It takes four votes to grant certiorari, to actually hear a case. And so what that raises is sort of an interesting strategic question, which is if you are in a, say, the four-justice liberal majority or liberal group, should you grant cert in a case, because you only need four, but you don't grant cert if you don't think you can get the fifth vote or you don't think that you can win the case. So it's not surprising that the term appears very light for 2016-2017 because the justices are sort of not in the business of wanting to split more than they have to. At the same time, one could argue that strategically, what it really depends on is how the circuit court resolved the matter. If the circuit court resolved the matter in a way that you don't like, you may vote to grant cert and hope to pick up that majority vote. So I think what we're seeing right now is that the court has shied away, and I think Chief Justice John Roberts has sort of counseled restraint in terms of what the court is doing over the next time period. I do want to just throw out some ideas and some thoughts about what the court did this year. There are a couple of very, very important cases, one that was not specifically on your program, so I'll begin with that, and that's Fisher versus University of Texas. I will tell you that prior to Justice Scalia passing away, I did tell my constitutional law class in the fall that there was absolutely no question that the Supreme Court was going to reverse the University of Texas, that there were simply not five votes to uphold affirmative action, and what that would have meant was that the U.S. Supreme Court was going to overturn a case called Grutter versus Gratz, which was the University of Michigan law school case that had upheld affirmative action. Justice Kennedy had never voted prior to Fisher for upholding an affirmative action case. Basically, the issue there is whether you can take race into account under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And Kennedy had always taken the view that although you can take socioeconomic status into account and you can take certain proxies for race into account, you can't take race itself into account in decision making. And of course, in California, it's somewhat of a moot issue because of our own proposition process. But Justice Kennedy flipped on that. But if you read the case, he seems to limit it very much to the facts of the case and the situation presented in Texas. And there's lots of warning language about how not only must other jurisdictions understand that this is a limited situation, but even Texas itself has to understand that it has to be diligent in overseeing any sort of race-based affirmative action program. That was a 4-3 decision. Justice Elena Kagan recused herself because when she was at the Justice Department, she was involved in the case earlier. A case that is very important, and I know that we have two other speakers on it, but I can't get up here and not talk about it, is Whole Women's Health, Koenig versus Hellerstedt. This is a remarkable case because the court seemed to breathe new life into the so-called undue burden standard that had been crafted back in 1992 in a case called Casey, the Pennsylvania case. In that decision, the Supreme Court had overruled certain aspects of Roe v. Wade, but had not overruled the trimester framework, but did not overrule viability as an important point in the decision-making process. But the court marched out a whole new test, which basically said that if the regulation operated as an undue burden to the exercise of the woman's right of reproductive freedom, it was unconstitutional. Since 1992, there's been a great deal of debate about what the undue burden stands for. Traditionally, in Supreme Court decision-making, the court establishes what's called tiered scrutiny, which is rational basis review, which is the lightest scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, which is what it sounds like, intermediate, and then strict scrutiny, which is extremely rigorous and hard to pass. The undue burden standard, of course, took us out of that tiered scrutiny, and there are a number of cases, including one that's very important for understanding what's going on here, is the case of Gonzalez versus Carhart. You probably know Gonzalez from its street name, which is the partial birth abortion case. In the partial birth abortion case, Gonzalez versus Carhart, the court seemed to jettison and get rid of the undue burden standard, not by getting rid of the test, by getting rid of any teeth that the test had. That is that the court was essentially, in Gonzalez versus Carhart, virtually completely deferential to the Bush administration and the Republican Congress's view as to whether a health exception was necessary to a ban on partial birth abortions, which of course is a medical fact. And the court basically said that we are not going to independently assess the question whether a health exception is necessary to a ban on partial birth abortions. We're going to be deferential to the political system. Well, from a constitutional standpoint, Whole Woman's Health changed everything, because basically the court said is we are not going to be deferential to either legislative or even lower court decision making on what could be called a constitutional fact, a fact that has constitutional dimensions. The court has an independent responsibility to determine that. Now, Justice Kennedy, who actually gave the opinion to Justice Breyer to write, Justice Kennedy wrote Gonzalez versus Carhart, and yet he was in the majority in Whole Woman's Health. So as my students know, my view of Justice Kennedy is he's something of a loose cannon. He has very little principled constitutional jurisprudence to fall back on. And so he seems to be all over the place in these cases, which is not a surprise, however disappointing it might be. Let me just finish up by talking about two cases that from a health sciences perspective are worth watching for next term. There are two cases that the court has granted cert on. One is the question of how the states define intellectual disability
So in two cases, Atkins versus Virginia and Hall versus Florida, the U.S. Supreme Court held that if you are intellectually disabled when you commit a crime that is a capital offense, you cannot be executed under the Eighth Amendment, that you do not have the capacity to have understood and you are not deterrable, so therefore the Eighth Amendment doesn't permit you to be executed. The problem was, how do you define intellectual disability? In the latest case in Hall, the Supreme Court seemed to adopt the DSM-5 standard for intellectual disability, and Texas had ignored that injunction, and Texas had used an old standard for defining intellectual disability, and so the Supreme Court has granted certiorari to determine whether the Texas state approach for defining intellectual disability, for exempting somebody from the death penalty, was or was not constitutional under the Eighth Amendment. It's a huge issue in psychiatry and psychology, very much worth following. The second one is a little bit more of a stretch, but there's a case where a prosecutor identified the defendant. The issue in the case was whether the defendant, in order to be executed, had to be found likely to be violent, so it was a prediction of violence, again, a psychiatric prediction of violence. In the case, the prosecutor pointed out that the defendant shared characteristics that indicated that he was likely to be violent in the future, but also expressly pointed out that the defendant was African American and that race was a correlate for likelihood of future violence. The court is likely not to accept that depiction. The problem is actually much deeper, and that is that when you look at actuarial devices that predict violence, there are a lot of factors like prior arrests, socioeconomic status, levels of education that are highly correlated with race. And so the question in this context is, can you use an actuarial statistical prediction of likelihood of violence that has such a high correlation to race, especially if it's a prior arrest? If you, as I think many people understand today, that police are more likely to stop and more likely to arrest and possibly more likely to indict for prosecutors African-Americans than they are Caucasians or other groups, then the fact that you have a higher arrest rate for a certain group may actually indicate bias and might make the actuarial predictions themselves biased and unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. So I'll end there, and I look forward to sort of weighing in from time to time with the other comments. Thank you.
Thank you, David. So Dan and Diane, if you guys, you can do it here or wherever. Place you prefer. Come on.
Great. Thanks so much for the invitation to speak today, and thanks for that nice kind of legal overview of the case. Since I am not a lawyer, and I'll probably mess up the legal stuff, I'm going to kind of give you a little bit more of my personal perspective, having been involved in this case of Whole Woman's Health. So since 2011, I have been collaborating with colleagues at the University of Texas at Austin as part of a project called the Texas Policy Evaluation Project, where we've been evaluating the impact of legislation in the state on reproductive health. And because of the comprehensive data that we had collected on abortion services in the state, I was asked to be an expert witness for the plaintiff in this case, and I was fortunate enough to also attend the oral argument before the Supreme Court in March, which was really very exciting. So to give you a little bit of background, I know many of you who I know in this audience are very familiar with this, but since Roe v. Wade was passed, states have passed a little over 1,000 laws regulating abortion, and they've really accelerated in recent years. So about over close to 300 of those laws were passed between 2011 and 2015. And more recently, many of these laws have been focused on sort of the supply side of abortion, focusing on providers, the effect of these laws is really to make abortion more difficult for providers to actually provide, or sometimes even impossible. Sometimes these are referred to as targeted regulation of abortion providers, or TRAP laws. And the two provisions that were at issue in from Texas House Bill 2 or HB 2 that were at issue in the Whole Woman's Health case are considered TRAP laws. So one of these provisions requires physicians in Texas providing abortion to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the facility. And while this might sound like a good idea in theory, in reality, it was very difficult for physicians in Texas to actually obtain privileges. Many of these physicians only provided outpatient care, so they didn't have case lists for surgery or patients that they had admitted into a hospital, and these were often required by hospitals in order to get admitting privileges. In smaller towns, in interviews that we did across the state, we heard from physicians who said that they couldn't find a physician who already had admitting privileges at the hospital who was willing to essentially be their backup and come out publicly and support their application, really because of stigma. And there were even a few cases where physicians were directly told by hospitals that they weren't going to grant admitting privileges to an abortion provider. There's also no evidence that having or requiring admitting privileges improves the quality of abortion care. The reality is that abortion, as it's currently provided in the U.S., largely in outpatient clinics, is very, very safe. Only about 2 women out of 1,000 have a serious complication that requires treatment in a hospital. And when inpatient care is required due to a complication, it's not necessary that the physician who actually performs the abortion be the one who admits the patient. Sometimes it needs to be another kind of specialist who needs to direct the care of the patient. So the result of the admitting privileges requirement was that clinics closed when physicians couldn't obtain or maintain these hospital admitting privileges. So as part of our research, we kind of closely monitored the clinics in the state. So in April of 2013, before HB2 was introduced, there were 41 facilities in the state providing abortion. Between May and October 2013, during the time which this law was introduced and debated and passed, 8 facilities closed because they knew that they couldn't comply with this requirement. On November 1st, 2013, when the admitting privileges went into effect, an additional 11 clinics closed on that day, leaving 22 facilities open. By June of this year, when the decision came out, there were only 17 open facilities in Texas providing abortion, so a decline of close to 60%. Most of these closures were in or had the biggest impact, I think, in smaller cities and more rural areas of the state, but there were also closures in the large urban centers as well. The second provision that was at issue in this case was a requirement that all abortion facilities in the state meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers, or ASCs. There's a great deal of published evidence showing that first trimester abortion performed in outpatient clinics is equally as safe as an abortion performed in an ASC or even in a hospital. ASC requirements are focused on procedures that require strictly sterile procedures, more complex procedures. They mandate things like the size of the operating room, airflow in the operating room, the size or the width of the hallway, nursing requirements, among other things. And these requirements are not relevant to a vacuum aspiration abortion, which by definition is not a sterile procedure. And perhaps the most illogical part of the Texas requirement was that even facilities that only provided medication abortion, which really just involves taking pills, even those facilities had to meet these same standards and essentially have women take the pill in an operating room. The ASC requirement had not gone into effect at the time of the district court hearing of Whole Woman's Health, and the judge's ruling blocked enforcement of this provision. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the district court ruling, and for 2 weeks in October 2014, there were only 10 facilities providing abortion care because those were the only ones that could meet the ASC standards. When the U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay of the appellate court ruling, 9 clinics immediately opened. So it really, and I think it was Justice Kagan who referred to this, it was really kind of a very clear evidence about how these provisions were directly related to the closures. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the research that we performed that was considered by the courts. We were really very interested in knowing what happened to the abortion statistics after this very restrictive, perhaps the most restrictive abortion law in the country went into effect. And the usual way you would do this kind of research is to look at state vital statistics records, because Texas is a state that requires all the abortion providers to submit detailed data on every abortion procedure that's done. The problem is Texas takes about 2 years before they make these data publicly available, by which time this case would have been long decided. So we decided that we had to collect the data ourselves. And luckily, as I mentioned, we've been working since 2011 doing research with abortion providers, so we had good relationships with them. As you might imagine, this is kind of a mistrustful group, and they don't really like working with outsiders, but we were very lucky that we had developed relationships with them. And so over the course of about 4 months in 2014, we collected detailed monthly statistics from all the abortion providers in the state that had been open since November 2012, including the ones that closed. And we analyzed these data, wrote it up in a paper that was published in a peer-reviewed journal, Contraception, shortly before the district court hearing in August 2014. And so for this analysis, what we did was we looked at the abortion statistics during the first 6 months after HB2 went into effect and compared that to the same period a year prior. We found that the total number of abortions in Texas declined by 13% statewide, which is a much steeper decline than had been seen in Texas in recent years or, in fact, nationally. That decline was much more pronounced, about a 21% decline, for women who were residents of the Rio Grande Valley, which was an area where, at that time, all the abortion clinics had closed. And perhaps the most concerning finding was that we found a small but significant increase in the proportion of abortions that were done in the second trimester. And that's concerning because, from a public health perspective, because although later abortion is still very safe, it is associated with a higher risk of complications compared to first trimester abortion. It's also more expensive for women and much harder to find a provider. In the district court case, Texas argued that our data couldn't be trusted because we had to wait for the official statistics, which were going to be at least another 2 years in coming. The judge did not agree, and our findings were considered in his ruling. I'll say just as a side note, Texas finally released the data for 2014, which is the first full year since HB2 went into effect. They released those results 3 days after the Supreme Court ruling, which was interesting, after they were accused of intentionally delaying the release of the data. And in fact, the 2014 official statistics are even more concerning than what we found. Statewide, there was a 14% decline in abortions. For residents of the lower Rio Grande Valley, there was a 56% decline in abortions. And second trimester abortion increased by 27%. So regarding the ambulatory surgical center provision, part of my testimony looked at the capacity of the existing ASCs to meet the demand for abortions statewide. So we showed in our research that prior to November 2013, when the admitting privileges requirement went into effect, the existing ASCs provided about 26% of all abortions statewide. So when the admitting privileges provision went into effect and about half the clinics closed, some of the clinics really ramped up services and were able to increase their numbers to meet the demand. But that didn't happen actually at the ASCs. In fact, during that first 6 month period after the law went into effect, the proportion of abortions that they performed statewide actually went down to 22%. And so I said in my testimony that it seemed highly unlikely that these existing ASCs could increase the number of procedures that they performed by essentially a factor of four if all of the non-ASCs closed. So I don't have time to go into detail about all the other research that we did, some of which was included in my testimony, some of which was included in amicus briefs, some of which came out after the amicus briefs were submitted but were covered in the press. But just quickly, I mean, we did things like we interviewed women who were delayed in their whole abortion process because of the clinic closures and they were pushed into the second trimester. We did interviews with some women who were unable to get the abortion that they wanted to get because of the clinic closures. We performed a statewide survey of abortion patients and showed how women whose nearest clinic closed between 2013 and 2014 traveled much farther to get an abortion, on average 80 miles each way, compared to women whose nearest clinic was still open. They also paid much more for the whole, their out-of-pocket expenditures were higher. We tracked the wait times to get into a clinic and showed how those increased as clinics closed. For example, in Dallas-Fort Worth, when one high-volume clinic closed, the wait times went up to about 21 days on average in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and sometimes actually even longer. And we also did research on self-induced abortion, which I could talk about if you're interested. But just returning to the decision, as you said, I think that this ruling really does now provide some judicial standard related to undue burden. The court said that restricting abortion can't just be considered in the abstract, or just because a legislature says that these laws will be beneficial. Instead, courts have to look at the potential benefit of the law compared to the potential risks. And in the case of these provisions of HB2, the court highlighted how safe abortion is, including citing data about how it's safer than other outpatient procedures that aren't regulated in the same way. And on the other side, there was really evidence of substantial harm to women because of the clinic closures that resulted from these provisions. I think the impact of this ruling already has been and will continue to be quite important. The day after the ruling, the Supreme Court rejected appeals from Mississippi and Wisconsin regarding challenges to similar laws requiring hospital admitting privileges that had been blocked at the Court of Appeals level. Shortly thereafter, Alabama also dropped its appeal of a similar admitting privileges law. And in Indiana, a federal judge blocked a law banning abortion in cases of genetic abnormalities, and that was all in the first week after the decision. In Texas, the impact of this ruling so far has been mostly great in terms of just boosting morale. After years of being under attack, abortion providers and reproductive rights advocates, you know, really finally got a very significant win. In terms of actually improving access to abortion in the state, the most immediate effect is that some of the physicians who were providing before but unable to provide because they didn't have admitting privileges are now able to provide at open clinics. But it's going to take time before either new clinics open or clinics that closed reopen. You know, once a clinic closes, often they lose the lease, they lose their license, they sell the equipment, the doctor may move away, so it's really not so easy just to open up these clinics again. Texas is wasting no time in pushing out its next round of non-evidence-based restrictions. The state just issued new regulations that are scheduled to go into effect in the fall that will require all fetal tissue to be cremated or buried. There are already rumors about the restrictions on abortion provision and actually possibly even on research that will be introduced in the 2017 legislative session. So before I end, I just wanted to say a tiny bit about what it was like for me personally to be involved in this case. I feel really lucky. I think we were just kind of in the right place at the right time. We had been there working in the state for a while and were able to quickly collect data about this incredibly restrictive law. I'm really proud of the work that we did. It was a team working not only with University of Texas, UCSF, but also University of Alabama at Birmingham and the nonprofit IBIS Reproductive Health. And while it's been generally very rewarding to be a part of this, at times it's also been personally quite challenging. In its brief to the Supreme Court, Texas spent an inordinate number of pages trying to discredit our research. They named me 31 times in their brief to the Supreme Court. They accused part of my testimony of being Ipsy Dixit, which I had to go look up to figure out what that meant. And so the fact that the majority ruling cites and refers to our research and my testimony is really a nice vindication of our work. I see this decision as really kind of a victory of science over ideology. The majority ruling is not really full of poetic quotes. It's kind of a dry review of the evidence. Evidence on the safety of abortion, on the evidence of the harms associated with these provisions of HB2, and the lack of any benefit. And it says not just that research may be considered when imposing legal restrictions on abortion care, but that it must be. As Linda Greenhouse wrote in the New York Times, this was really an example of evidence-based medicine meeting evidence-based law, which I think is really quite exciting. So thank you.
Okay, Dan stole my line. I wanted to tell you this as a story of the triumph of science over politics. This case really hinged on whether women still access care under restrictions that close the majority of clinics in Texas. And the majority opinion is all about whether Dan's testimony is credible. As a scientist who studies access to care, is his opinion credible about whether 10 clinics could serve over 5 million women of reproductive age in Texas? The scientific community weighed in on this case through submission of friend of the court briefs. I coordinated an amicus brief that was signed by 4 dozen social scientists from 32 institutions, including 10 scientists from UCSF. And if you didn't already know, UCSF is a major leader in reproductive health research. And some would say it was just because of the alphabet, but I know it's true that Nancy Adler's name went first. She's our UCSF director of the Center for Health and Community. Her name is the first on the list of signees. Why she should go first is because she was a pioneer in the study of the mental health effects of abortion. The social scientist amicus brief was cited in Justice Breyer's majority decision and Justice Ginsburg's concurring opinion. And although the brief covered many areas, the effect of trap laws on providers and quality of care, the effect of access to abortion on women's well-being, what was cited directly was a UCSF study on abortion safety. UCSF Associate Professor Ushma Upadhyay led a study based on 55,000 abortions in California that showed that major complications from abortion are less than 0.25%. Past abortion cases have shown that decisions go very badly when there's an absence of science. Justice Anthony Kennedy's majority decision in Gonzalez v. Carhart said, "While we find no reliable data to measure the phenomenon, it seems unexceptional to conclude that some women come to regret their decision to abort." He based his decision on an amicus brief submitted by women who regretted their abortions, and he had no way to know whether that was a common phenomenon. Well, now we do have the data. Advancing New Standards of Reproductive Health, a program within the UCSF Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health, has been dedicated to generating the evidence needed to base policy on fact and not supposition. Dr. Upadhyay and Dr. Sarah Roberts have led studies examining the effect of state abortion restrictions on access to care, finding some restrictions that have no effect and others that have unintended negative consequences. And I've led the Turnaway Study, a prospective longitudinal study of women who receive abortions and women who are denied abortions from clinics across the country. We follow women over time to ask about their physical health and mental health, socioeconomic well-being, subsequent pregnancies, and the health and well-being of their children. The women denied abortions were denied due to advanced gestational age, and so our study recruited women as a separate subsample of women in the first trimester who represent the vast majority of abortion patients in the country. And based on the UCSF Turnaway study data, UCSF Assistant Professor Karine Rocca, who's also here, has shown that 95% of women who having abortions do not regret their decisions. UCSF social psychologist Antonia Biggs has shown that abortion does not have negative mental health consequences in terms of depression, anxiety, or PTSD symptoms. So why is there such a social science consensus on abortion safety and the negative consequences of a lack of abortion access? Those of us who study abortion know that abortion is associated with lower physical health risks than childbirth. Access to abortion care for women who are experiencing an unwanted pregnancy makes a significant difference in their ability to leave violent relationships, stay employed, make aspirational one-year plans for their life, and take care of the children they already have. So we at UCSF continue to work to generate scientific evidence to contribute to health policy debates.
Thank you both for that terrific discussion of that case, and I think Adam's comments coming up next are very important because it really goes to the other side of the divide, which is what happens when the law makes it more difficult to collect the data that allows you to do research. So Adams, I'll turn it over to you.
So I find it helpful to think almost always cases that reach the Supreme Court are balancing one social need versus another, and you may disagree with whether or not there's a social need, but it's helpful to try and raise up what are the issues that people are talking about. And so I'm going to now talk about a very different topic, and I it'll help me to understand your background. How many people here know who Jimmy Hoffa was? Okay. If it had been medical students, no hands would have gone up. The real issue for the real social problem that the law I'm going to talk about called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income and Security Act, was addressing was that unions were being handed large pots of money for the purposes of managing pension benefits and smaller pots of money, but still significant pots of money for the purposes of managing health benefits. And there's now substantial evidence that there was a lot of dipping of the hand into the pot to take some of the money out of the pension and health benefits pools. And that was one of the main issues that corruption on the union side was creating. It all was not rosy on the other side of this equation either, though. So a part of the rationale for having ERISA was that large employers would go around promising things like lifetime benefits, lifetime pension benefits, or lifetime health insurance benefits. And then if they went bankrupt, so based on everyone knowing Jimmy Hoffa, who knows, who's ever heard of Studebaker? So big car company that that went bankrupt, and when it went bankrupt, just completely abandoned pension benefits for thousands of its employees, including long-term employees. And so there was this need. We need to have big pools of money for the purposes of ensuring that pension benefits and healthcare benefits are there, especially if they have a long time horizon. And yet at the same time, we need to have some management rules about those pools of money so that people can't just go in and take their bit and disappear, whether that's taking the bit. So what the companies often did, even those who didn't go bankrupt, was if they weren't going to make their quarterly profit estimates, they'd just cut the payments to the pension benefits and they'd have more savings. And so we needed some rules about how big pots of money were developed. As this conversation evolved through the 50s and 60s, the large employers started saying, well, yeah, but we work in lots of places. Like General Motors said, we work all around the country. We don't want 50 different sets of rules. We want a federal set of rules that preempts everybody else's rules. So Alabama can't come along and tell us to do something totally different than what Montana's telling us. So in the 1970s, ERISA was passed, and it did exactly that. So it set up rules for managing pension and health benefits, pots of money, and it preempted for large employers who self-insured, in terms of healthcare specifically, who self-insured, it preempted all state laws. And this was very new because previously states had been in charge of the health insurance function. It said, in addition, states could not make insurance laws that would affect ERISA-covered institutions and create an undue burden for them in terms of their attempts to create and manage the health benefit for their self-insured employees or their employees under their self-insured plan. So now we get to the case that happened, this Gobe case. So what's going on? Well, as you all know, healthcare costs have risen dramatically, and evidence that there are quality problems and waste problems in healthcare is now very, very strong. And one of the thoughts, one of the policy initiatives has been, hey, let's all put all our data together. If I were to look at Dr. Dudley and just say how well he's doing, and I'm just Blue Shield of California, which has about 10% of the market share, then I only get a small slice of Dr. Dudley's activity. Random events will affect that, and I may not get a very good picture of how well he's doing. And so it is better if we can all put our data into a single place and begin to generate the evidence that we were hearing about on which to base policy. So this was thought as a key infrastructure step in addressing healthcare quality and cost. And the idea was to create what's called an all-payer claims database. Vermont was among, there are now 18 states with laws that say we're going to do such a thing. Liberty Mutual sued Vermont over this in federal court saying, hey, this Vermont law violates ERISA because we're self-insured. Liberty Mutual was doing this over 17 employees in the state. And Liberty Mutual is an insurance company, but they're not that kind of insurance company. They're not a health insurance company. They had a health insurance company with which they had a contract, and they were basically suing to stop that company from contributing data on those 17 people to the Vermont all-payer claims database. The Supreme Court ruled that this was a violation of ERISA, and so, at least for right now, Vermont is not allowed to force Liberty Mutual to do this. In my mind, as a researcher who has not only used data that is combined from multiple sources, including multiple insurance companies, but also who has had to create such databases, this reflects a significant misunderstanding of how much actual burden there would be. And in fact, the burden here is negative. So the standard is there an undue burden? For an insurance company to go through and find the 17 Liberty Mutual employees and their claims is much more, and pull them out and then hand over the rest of their data to the state of Vermont, is far more expensive than just taking all their data and handing it over to the state of Vermont. So I do not understand. I understand how you would want to uphold the principle, and Justice Kennedy's states' rights thing notwithstanding, uphold the principle that ERISA preempts burdensome state laws. I just don't see how this could possibly have been perceived as a burden. In fact, in another panel in which insurance companies were complaining about this burden, this was the complaint. I was sitting next to someone from United Health Group, which is currently the second largest insurer in America. Just a few days after they had announced their annual revenues of $126 billion, with a B, this person sat on a panel at the National Association of Health Data Organizations and said if they were to comply with 50 different states' requirements, that they all be different. This is sitting in an organization which has proposed national standards so that they could all be the same. But sitting there and saying if 50 different states came up with 50 different data formats for us to submit this, it could cost us $1 million with an M. So it's very hard for me to see how just complying, the cost of $1 million to create a data context in which we could generate much better evidence in any way constitutes a burden when the revenue flow is $126 billion. But one thing that would in fact increase that number is to go through and selectively pull out certain people. That would definitely substantially increase the cost. But it's sort of, you understand why I'm saying it's a negative burden? So I completely disagree with the Supreme Court on this, on the application of this standard, although I think I understand why they did what they did. Fortunately, there are some options. So as I mentioned, the National Association of Health Data Organizations has put forward a standard for what this data should look like, and it is allowed under ERISA for the Department of Labor to say, we're going to preempt all state laws and by the mechanism of adopting this standard and saying, or some other standard, any other standard, and saying if states want to do this, they can as long as they use this standard. So they could do that, but they haven't shown any inclination. They could have done that. They could have maybe even stopped the whole case from getting to the Supreme Court if they had done that. But hopefully they will. Another alternative would be for the Department of Labor, for Vermont to apply to the DOL for a waiver rather than having fought the issue at the Supreme Court. They could have asked DOL for a waiver. And the final option is for Congress to change ERISA, which is extremely unlikely, I think. This is the kind of conversation I wish we actually were having instead of the political conversation we are having, is what are the social problems that we have? Well, we need to manage pots of money, and we need to have some rules for them. But it also is better if those rules aren't complicated and aren't burdensome. And how can we move forward with that? And at the same time, we also need to create data about this particularly important, these two particularly important problems of healthcare cost and healthcare quality. And this might be a way that we could have some collective action, allow the states to experiment, have 50 different labs for how to address healthcare quality and healthcare cost. And unfortunately, it seems to me this rather unreasonable Supreme Court decision stands in the way of states being able to do that. And hopefully, the Department of Labor will step up and do something about that. Thanks.
So we have a few minutes left. This is always my favorite day of the year because I always learn a lot. So we saw undue burden pop up in a couple of different cases, and I didn't know that was going to happen until hearing Adam's comments.
A couple of quick observations, but you should go ahead, Sev. First of all, ipsedixit means because I said so. So every parent who's had a teenager knows and uses ipsedixit. And then one comment that I failed to include is my prediction about Merrick Garland and whether he will get a seat on the Supreme Court. My prediction, I'll go on the record, is that if Hillary Clinton wins the election, and in particular if the Democrats take the Senate, Garland will be a Supreme Court justice by the middle of November. And if not, then bets are off. But they're not going to get an appointment as good as Garland if Hillary Clinton is president.
Great. And while you folks are thinking, I have a question actually for, I don't know if it's for Diana or Dan, but I think one of the things that's most impressive about the discussion of this case is both how you brought evidence to bear, but also that you were thinking about these issues 5-6 years in advance of when they became relevant for the court. And clearly, in the previous case, not having the data led to a very different type of decision by the court. So I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit about the research that you're doing now and the extent to which you have confidence that that might be involved in future decisions that may come down the pike based on how you see the politics of this playing out across the different states.
I'd been doing work in Texas even before 2011 with colleagues at the University of Texas at Austin in the El Paso area, actually looking at women who were getting contraception across the border in Mexico over the counter. And we saw how women were just struggling to meet their reproductive health needs even back then. And it was then in the 2011 legislative cycle, Texas cut the family planning budget by 2/3, essentially to cut Planned Parenthood out from receiving these funds, but it ended up having an effect to really close other small nonprofit family planning services. So, and we just saw how somebody needed to study what was going to go on there. They passed also an abortion restriction in that legislative cycle, which now in retrospect seems pretty benign. It required women to make an extra visit at least 24 hours before the law went into effect. In terms of moving forward, I mean, we're planning to continue our work in Texas and hopefully see what happens as the clinics start to reopen and try to show that there some of this the change in the abortion statistics actually are reversed. We're also doing work on other kind of abortion-related policies, for example. I mean, Diana talked about several different things. We're also doing work, for example, on telemedicine provision of medication abortion. About 18 states have passed laws showing or trying to ban telemedicine for the provision of abortion, despite evidence that we've collected showing how it's safe, effective, and women really like it.
So you mentioned the dramatic increase in abortion rules after 2011. A big part of that was that two things happened. One was the new census came out, and the other was the 2010 midterm elections, which were largely ignored by moderate and conservative, moderate and liberal voters. And my impression is that people thought Obama got elected, the nation's changed, everyone's saying the GOP's dead, and so a whole swath of the electorate didn't go to the next set of elections. And when you combined the new census data, which shifted more population to certain areas of certain states, with big Republican gains in those intermediate elections, what happened was the opportunity to gerrymander. Districts had to be redrawn, and there was an opportunity to gerrymander, and there was an awful lot of gerrymandering that happened immediately after the 2010 census, and that made it possible to pass a lot of these laws. So, and to do things like make laws saying you can't study X, Y, and Z. And so, so now to wrap around to a university rule, I think it was fantastic that you were already there, and that is one of the things that universities have to do in our world. Is we have to be the place where an independent voice can exist, where and it's also why I'm focusing, and if anyone wants to help me, let me know, on independent philanthropy to this and other universities. Is we have to have ways around the funding restrictions and around the political restrictions on just getting to the evidence on which policy is based. And that is actually much more of a need since the 2010 census and midterm elections than it was before, because there's much more of this you can't talk about. Now we can't talk about it. There are places where we're not supposed to do research about abortions. A long time we haven't been able to talk about guns. NIH is not allowed to address healthcare costs. All these things that are huge social issues that we absolutely should be talking about, not tweeting insults at each other, but talking about with evidence. We can't do, so we need universities to be a place where at least some of that conversation can be started, and we need philanthropy to make that possible, because it's clear that state governments and federal government are not going to fill that hole. It's going to have to come from individual and foundation philanthropy.
So dig deep in your pockets. Before, I'm going to give David Fagman the last word, but I do want to just acknowledge Ashley and Jay and John for making this event possible, and thank you guys for pulling this together from the consortium.
Thank you.
I'll try to be quick. But both Dan and Adams raised an issue that I think really needs to be highlighted, especially at the intersection of law and science. And first of all, I'll say I'm not sure that science has prevailed quite yet, but we'll wait and see on that. But one of the issues in this context that you as researchers need to be aware of is the question of what is the constitutionally relevant empirical issue that's at stake. And very quickly, if you go back to Brown versus Board of Education, when Thurgood Marshall was orchestrating his attack on segregated schooling, he found the research that was done by Kenneth Clark, the so-called doll studies. And what Kenneth Clark, who's a researcher at Columbia, had done was he looked at the national statistics on whether black school children were being injured by segregated schools. And Thurgood Marshall said, I need that research. But what Marshall then did was he sent Kenneth Clark to the five jurisdictions that were actually involved in the Brown litigation, and he redid the research in each of those, in Topeka, in Richmond, in D.C., to see if they would replicate in the individual jurisdictions. When they got to the Supreme Court, Robert Carter was arguing the Topeka case for the NAACP, and Justice Hugo Black said the Topeka District Court had found that the black school children in Topeka were injured by segregated schools. So Justice Black said, well, are you making this empirical argument for the school children in Topeka, or are you making this argument for national standard? And Robert Carter, I think, made the mistake by saying, we're simply arguing that the Supreme Court should be deferential to the district court's fact-finding. We're only talking about Topeka. Well, Black came back and said, well, wait a minute now. You're saying that we have to relitigate every single case in every school district in the country. And so as researchers, you have to ask yourselves, what is the operational definition? What is the operational construct that you're measuring? And in the abortion context, just to bring it home, think about the 24-hour waiting provision. The 24-hour waiting provision has been argued for more than 25 years now to be an undue burden. And there's a good deal of research on whether having to wait 24 hours is an undue burden. The question as a researcher, how do you study that? And one could argue, in fact, there's a Seventh Circuit case that does argue this, is that the undue burden might be different for a 24-hour waiting provision in Delaware, Rhode Island, than it would be in Montana or Wisconsin. And so I would, not just because I do this for a living, but I would urge you, because talking to Dan and Diana beforehand, what you see in that case is both the facts on the ground in Texas, but it also has to apply to Mississippi and Wisconsin. Well, if all you had were the facts on the ground in Texas, then Wisconsin, Mississippi might not follow the Supreme Court's decision. But what Diana did in the amicus brief is to say, these facts are true nationally, not only locally. And so as you consider, you know, this question of how you're doing research that might be constitutionally relevant, you do have to ask the question, well, how are you defining the constitutional fact that is of research consequence? Anyway, I'll end there.
Thank you. This has been these are interesting political times, but this was an extremely inspirational panel and discussion. And thank you very much, panelists, for making.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.